Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. It is Friday, April the 12th, 2024. My name is Stuart Bronze. U.S. hosts leaders of Japan, Philippines, trilateral summit. Biden says U.S. support ironclad amid China provocations. Washington. President Joe Biden said U.S. defense commitment to Pacific allies was ironclad as he gathered Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida at the White House on Thursday in the midst of growing concern about provocative Chinese military action in the Indo-Pacific. The U.S. and the Philippines have had a mutual treaty in place for more than 70 years. Biden's forceful reinforcement of the American commitment comes in the midst of persistent skirmishes between the Philippine and Chinese coast guards in the disputed South China Sea. The United States' defense commitments to Japan and to the Philippines are ironclad. They're ironclad, Biden said as he began three-way talks at the White House with Kishida and Marcos. As I have said before, any attack on Philippine aircraft, vessels, or armed forces in the South China Sea would invoke our mutual defense treaty. Chinese action in the Pacific was expected to be a large focus on the leaders' talks. The White House sees the first ever trilateral summit with Japan and Philippines as a potent response to the attempts at intimidation and sending a message that China is the outlier in the neighborhood, an administration official said. The leaders are also expected to announce that their coast guards will hold a joint patrol in the Indo-Pacific this year, a follow-up on law enforcement drills carried out last year by the allies in waters near the disputed South China Sea. The summit comes a day after Biden held one-on-one talks with Kishida and feted the Japanese premier with a glitzy state dinner at the White House, a diplomatic honor meant to recognize Tokyo's growing clout on the global stage. It was also designed to send a clear signal that the Democratic administration remains determined to build a latticework of alliances in the Indo-Pacific, even as it grapples with the Israel-Hamas war and Russia's ongoing invasion of Ukraine. Biden also hosted Marcos for a private meeting at the White House ahead of scheduled three-way talks. Today's summit is an opportunity to define the future that we want and how we intend to achieve it together, Marcos said. Thursday's three-day summit also had a large economic component with several major U.S.-based companies, including Meta, UPS, and Greenbrier Energy, announcing investments in the Philippines, administration officials said. The new deals come after Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo visited Manila last month to announce more than $1 billion in new investment by American companies in the Philippines. Biden also announced that the three nations will launch a new economic corridor in the Philippines as part of the G7 Partnership for Global Infrastructure Investment that would help develop clean energy, port, agriculture, and other projects in the country. The United States, the United Kingdom, and Japan on Wednesday announced a joint military exercises in the Indo-Pacific in 2025. That followed the Pentagon revealing this week that the U.S., the U.K., and Australia are considering including Japan in the AUKUS partnership, in grouping launched in 2021 that aims to equip Australia with nuclear-powered and conventionally armed submarines. Kishida visited Capitol Hill on Thursday and for an address to the United States lawmakers, the focus on the need to strengthen the partnership between the U.S. and Japan at a time of tension in the Asia-Pacific and skepticism in Congress about U.S. involvement abroad. He offered concern about the undercurrent of self-doubt among some Americans about what your role in the world should be, but China loomed large over Thursday's talk at the White House. Relations between China and the Philippines have been repeatedly tested by skirmishes involving the two nations, Coast Guard vessels in the disputed South China Sea. Chinese Coast Guard ships also regularly approach disputed Japanese-controlled East China Seas islands near Taiwan. The gray zone, harassment by China, including shiny military-grade lasers at Filipino Coast Guard, firing water cannons at vessels and ramming into Philippine ships near the Second Thomas Shoal, which both Manila and the Beijing claim. In 1999, Manila intentionally ran World War II-era ship aground on the shoal, establishing a permanent military presence there. Biden, in a wide-ranging phone call with Chinese President Xi, last week raised concerns about China's operations in the South China Seas, including efforts to impede the Philippines, which the U.S. is treaty obligated to defend, from resupplying its forces on the Second Thomas Shoal. Biden has made improving relations with the Philippines a priority since Marcos became the country's president in June of 2022. The relationship had ups and downs over the years and was in a difficult place when Marcos took office. Human rights groups said Marcos' predecessor, Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs resulted in thousands of extrajudicial killings. Marcos, the son and namesake of the country's former dictator, as a candidate said he would look to pursue closer ties with China, but he's increasingly drifted toward Washington in concerns about the Chinese coercive action. Biden closes gun sale loopholes, expands background checks. New rules impact unlicensed dealers selling at places like gun shows over the internet. This article by Elena Durkin, Richer, and Colleen Long. Washington. Thousands more firearm dealers across the United States will have to run background checks on buyers when selling a gun at shows or other places outside brick-and-mortar stores, according to a Biden administration rule that will soon go into effect. The rule aims to close a loophole that has allowed tens of thousands of guns to be sold every year by unlicensed dealers who don't perform background checks to ensure the potential buyer is not legally prohibited from having a firearm. This is going to keep guns out of the hands of domestic abusers and felons. President Joe Biden said in a statement, "And my administration is going to continue to do everything we possibly can to save lives. Congress needs to finish the job and pass universal background checks legislation now." The rule, which was finalized this week, makes clear that anyone who sells firearms predominantly to earn a profit must be federally licensed and conduct background checks, regardless of whether they are selling on the internet, at a gun show, or at a brick-and-mortar store, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland told reporters. Biden made curtailing gun violence a major part of his administration and re-election campaign, creating the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, overseen by Vice President Kamala Harris. Biden also urged Congress to ban so-called assault weapons, something Democrats shied away from just a few years ago. The rule is likely to be challenged in court by gun rights activists who believe the Democratic president is unfairly targeting gun owners. The National Rifle Association said it is already working to use all means available to stop this unlawful rule. The National Shooting Sports Foundation, an industry trade group, also warned of a court challenge if the rule was finalized as written. Lawrence Keene, the foundation's senior vice president and general counsel, said Thursday the organizations were reviewing the regulation after contending previously that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives was overstepping its legal authority. Biden administration officials said they are confident that the rule, which drew more than 380,000 public comments, would withstand lawsuits. The Biden administration first proposed the rule in August, after the passage of the most sweeping gun violence bill in decades, a bipartisan compromise in response to the massacre of 19 students and two teachers at Uvalde, Texas elementary school. That law expanded the definition of those who are engaged in the business of selling firearms and are required to become licensed by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and therefore run background checks. The rule, which implements the change in law, will take effect 30 days after it's published in the Federal Register. There are already about 80,000 federal licensed firearm dealers. Administration officials believe that the new rule will impact more than 20,000 dealers who have gotten away with selling firearms without a license and performing background checks at places like gun shows and over the internet by claiming they aren't engaged in the business of firearm sales. This final rule does not infringe on anyone's Second Amendment rights, and it will not negatively impact the many law-abiding licensed firearm dealers in our nations. ATF Director Steve Dettelbach said, "They are already playing by the rules." It comes a week after the ATF released new data that shows more than 68,000 illegally trafficked firearms in the U.S. came through unlicensed dealers who aren't required to perform background checks over a five-year period. The ATF also showed that guns trafficked through the unlicensed dealers were used in nearly 300 shootings between 2017 and 2021. Gun control advocates praise the regulation as a big step towards their goal of universal background checks for gun buyers, a Democratic priority that has been blocked by Republicans in Congress. Expanding background checks and closing the gun seller loophole is a massive victory for safer communities, and it was made possible thanks to the tireless advocacy of our grassroots movement. Angela Farrell Zabala, Executive Director of Moms Demand Action, said in an email statement. Briefly, embassy raid. Mexico's president said Thursday his country wants the United Nations to suspend Ecuador from the world body as part of the complaint to the top UN court over Ecuador's police raid last week on the Mexican embassy in Quito. Aid. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, is negotiating with the White House to advance aid for Ukraine and Israel in a deal that would deviate from a $95 billion Senate package and include several GOP demands, House Republican leader Steve Scalise, Republican Louisiana, said Thursday. Grants. The Biden administration awarded $830 million in grants Thursday to fund 80 projects aimed at toughening aging U.S. infrastructure against the impact of climate change. Oil. In a move environmentalists call a betrayal, the Biden administration approved construction of a deepwater oil export terminal this week off the Texas coast that would be the largest of its kind in the United States. Immigration. Authorities in the Dominican Republic said Thursday that they launched an investigation after an immigration officer was accused of breaking into a house and raping a 14-year-old girl last week. Mortgages. The average rate of a U.S. 30-year mortgage rose to 6.88% from 6.82% last week, mortgage buyer Freddie Mac said Thursday. Its highest level in 5 weeks. A year ago, it averaged 6.27%. Railroads ask courts to throw out safety rule. Federal authorities require two-person crew on freight trains. Associated Press. Four railroads asked federal appeals court this week to throw out a new rule that would require two-person train crews in most circumstances, saying the mandate is arbitrary, capricious, and a legal abuse of discretion. The identical challenges of the Federal Railroad Administration's rule were all filed this week in different appellate courts on behalf of the Union Pacific, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, and two short line railroads. A new federal requirement announced last week was a milestone in organized labor's long fight to preserve the practice and come amid increasing scrutiny into railroad safety. The industry has long opposed such a regulation, as the Association of American Railroads trade groups say the rule is unfounded and not supported by safety data. Union Pacific said in a statement that this rule, which lacks any data showing two people in a cab are safer than one, hinders our ability to compete. The Omaha-Nebraska Railroad earned $1.65 billion or $2.71 per share in the fourth quarter last year. Burlington Northern Santa Fe deferred comment to the AAR, and two smaller railroads didn't immediately respond to messages Thursday. Today is April 12th, Friday, 2024. This is Stuart Brahms, and you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger. Another lift is underway. The same local nonprofit that is restoring the Elks building has taken on a new task. Jane Curtis, Webster City. The building that burned and brought the Webster City Theater temporarily to its knees last fall has a new name and new ownership. The new moniker is 608. The new owner is LIFT, WC, or Local Initiative for Transformation, WC, Inc. It has always been bigger than the Elks building, Darcy Swan, LIFT's board president, said Tuesday. It's always been downtown revitalization at the core of what we're doing, and we always knew that once we got the building done, we were going to be looking at other projects to take on. It came about a little sooner than we were planning. Despite being in the middle of the massive historical renovation of the Elks building in the 700 block of 2nd Street in downtown Webster City, all of the members of LIFT WC agreed that the local nonprofit should undertake the mission of saving the burned out building. Structurally, it is sound, John Hawkins, Webster City Mayor and LIFT board member, said. We have an engineering report that said the building is quite capable of being rebuilt. The walls are fine. Yes, there's some damage on the top, but that can be redone, he said. The top floor is concrete floor from one end to the other. It's concrete. Now it's not concrete as we know it now, He said, it's clay brick at a solid field. It's what they did before they had precasting. He added, so the building's a very solid building. I mean, so it is worth saving, yeah? Also important to understand in the move is to save the building at 608's role and stabilizing its neighbors without it, different problems would arise. Ongoing now is a repair of the brick facade and the creation of brick until, excuse me. Ongoing now is a repair of the brick facade and creation of brick. Infill by James Vissi, a Fort Dodge masonry specialist. It would take several more weeks for that work to be complete. When it is, the immediate goal is to reopen the sidewalk. Imminent also is a new roof. Swin and Hawkins said the vast amount of water poured into the structure when battling the fire, coupled with any moisture from it being exposed to weather without a roof, has made some mold mitigation ultimately necessary as well. When those three things are completed, the building will be on the market for a purchaser who wants to take it to the rest of the way to have a new life. It'll just be completely framed. That's it, Hawkins said. And the same thing on the main level. It is still being gutted out. The framing will be still there. To help pay for the work, Hamilton County's Economic Development Director, Cindy Eim, is requesting a $100,000 U.S. grant, emergency catalyst grant from Iowa Economic Development. Hawkins said the city will also be asked to match the $100,000. Hawkins and John Harenstein, Webster City's interim manager, together discussed having the city take over the 608 building. He's definitely wanted to get something happening, and of course I wanted to get something happening. Ultimately, it made more sense for Lyft to take it under its wing. It goes back to reinforce really what this organization is about, Swin said. And we could not pass up the opportunity to do it, to reinforce who we are. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida addresses Congress, Washington, AP. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida addressed U.S. lawmakers at the Capitol on Thursday, urging them to consider the importance of global commitments at a time of tensions in the Asia-Pacific and deep skepticism in Congress about U.S. involvement abroad. Kishida is in Washington this week visiting President Joe Biden at the White House, completes hosting each other for the Quad, an informal partnership between the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India that is seen as important to countering China's growing military strength in the region. Kishida highlighted the value of the U.S. commitment to global security and offered reassurances that Japan is a strong partner. On Capitol Hill, his audience, including many Republicans, who have pushed for the U.S. to take a less active role in global affairs as they follow the America First ethos of Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. The Republicans-controlled House have said for months that the $95 billion package that would send wartime funding to Ukraine and Israel, as well as to aid allies in the Indo-Pacific like Taiwan and humanitarian help to civilians in Gaza and Ukraine. As we meet here today, I detect an undercurrent of self-doubt about some Americans, about what your role as the world should be, Kishida told Congress. He sought to remind lawmakers of the leading role the United States has played globally since World War II. After dropping two nuclear weapons on Japan at the end of the war, the U.S. helped rebuild Japan, and the nations transformed from bitter enemies to close allies. When necessary, it made noble sacrifices to fulfill its commitment to a better world, Kishida said, of the United States. Japan has taken a strong role in supporting Ukraine's defense against Moscow, as well as helping humanitarian to get to Gaza. It also is seen as a key U.S. partner in a region fraught with danger where China is asserting to strengthen North Korea's developing nuclear program. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said on the floor speech Thursday, the best way the House can heed Prime Minister Kishida's words is to pass the national security supplement as soon as possible to approve defense funding, not just for Ukraine, but also for the Indo-Pacific. Swamped school secretary struggles with overbearing parents. Dear Anne, and this is to the column, Dear Annie, I am a school secretary. Parents often call in with issues regarding their children. Some are very personal, including health, family issues, abuse, neglect, behavior, etc. Many parents go into full detail as to what is happening. In these circumstances, I am not the person who can assist them. Instead, I refer them to a counselor principal, nurse, or teacher. I don't blame them. They probably do not know where to start and they are struggling. However, it puts me in an awkward situation as I really do not need to know so much about their students, individuals that take up their time and my own. My question is, what is a polite way to cut them off and get them where they need to be without seeming insensitive to what they are going through? Signed, Sensitive Secretary. Dear Sensitive Secretary, first and foremost, if you suspect any abuse going on at the home, it's important that you report it to your local authorities. For other issues, your approach is exactly right, directing them to a more appropriate resource. It sounds like many of these parents are looking to vent more than they are expecting a solution. While this may be frustrating to you, I would try to reframe your mindset to view it as an honor that many parents trust you enough to confide in you. If these conversations are eating up your whole day, then I would interject with something like, I'm so sorry to hear that. Let me connect you to someone who can help you. But if it's 10 minutes here and there, I would channel your empathy and hear them out before looking for a way to cut them off. Dear Annie, my husband and I have been together for more than 30 years. He is very loving and a great father and provider. I fell in love with him because he was so level-headed and mild-mannered. We have two grown daughters. Our oldest now does not want to grow up and move out. She's very manipulative and resort to shouting. My problem is that we may discuss a resolution, but he cannot enforce it. Many times I feel like he defers to her manipulation over the relationship. I feel like I'll never be queen of his castle. Any advice? Wife with a waffling husband. Dear wife, it's understandable why you feel so defeated. Instead of being able to rely on your husband as a partner in parenting, you're left to play bad cop and lay down the law with your daughter. Have an open, honest conversation with your husband about his avoidance of discipline and making you feel. Avoidance of discipline is making you feel. His actions are not only impacting you, but also further enabling your daughter into continuing to depend on both of you. It's important that you two present and maintain a united front for each other, your daughter, and your marriage. Go and do around the area. Clarion. Clarion Coin Club Spring Show is 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. this Saturday at the Heartland Museum, Clarion. Admission is free. Livermore American Legion, Otto Field Post 415 Breakfast Fundraiser is 8:30 to 11:30 a.m. on this Sunday in the Livermore Legion Basement. The menu is pancakes, eggs, sausage, biscuits, and gravy and cinnamon rolls. Tickets are $10 a person. Fort Dodge Senior High Kosovo Fundraising Scavenger Hunt is 1 p.m. Saturday in the East Side Large Student Parking Lot at Fort Dodge Senior High, 819 North 25th Street. Teams of 3 to 5 are $10 per person with children ages 8 and under free. Each team will need a legal driver. Teams will travel around Fort Dodge decoding clues for prizes. Fort Dodge, the King Ringers Handbell Ensemble Spring Concert is 4 p.m. Sunday at the Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 14326 21st Avenue North. Refreshments will be served and a free will donation will be accepted. Fort Dodge, Almost Home for Ball is 6 to 10 p.m. Saturday at Fort Dodge Ford Toyota Showroom, 2723 5th Avenue South. There will be dinner, live and silent auctions, 50-50 raffle, door prizes, cash bar, and pet trivia. Advance tickets are $20 and they be purchased at Almost Home or online at almosthomeiowa.org. Tickets at the door are $25. The event will benefit the homeless pets at Almost Home Humane Society in Fort Dodge. Fort Dodge, Grind Shock, a documentary and discussion on human trafficking in Iowa, 10 a.m. to noon Saturday at the Larimer Ballroom, 710 First Avenue North. The event is free and open to the public. Fort Dodge, Community Health Center at Fort Dodge, Live Healthy, Iowa, 5K run is at 8 a.m. Saturday at Rosedale Rapids, 1111 North 32nd Street. Kids, 1K run begins at 9 a.m. Fort Dodge, Hillbilly Sale and Flea Market is 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday at the Webster City County Fairgrounds, 22770 Old Highway 169 South Gate. Admission is $2 per person, ages 12 and over. And lastly, Fort Dodge, Friends at Byron Nashville Songwriter Showcase benefits at 7 p.m. today at the historical Phillips Auditorium, 1015 5th Street North. The concert is to save Byron's Bar in Pomeroy from being closed down. Tickets are $50 per person and are available at the door. U.S. measles cases are up 2024. What's driving the increase? Devi Shastri, Mike Strobe, Associated Press. Measles outbreaks in the United States and abroad are raising health experts' concern about preventable, once common childhood virus. One of the world's most contagious diseases, measles can lead to potentially serious complications. The best defense, according to experts, get vaccinated. Here's what to know about the year so far on measles. How many measles cases are there in the United States seen this year? Nationwide measles cases are already double for all of last year. The U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention documented 113 cases as of April 3rd. There have been seven outbreaks in most of the U.S. cases. 73% are linked to those flare-ups. Still, the count is lower than some recent years. 2014, 667 cases, and 2019, 1,274 cases. What's the big deal? The 2019 measles epidemic was the worst in almost three decades and threatened the United States' status as a country that has eliminated measles by stopping the continual spread of the measles virus. The CDC on Thursday released a report on recent measles case trends, noting the cases in the first 3 months of this year were 17 times higher than the average number seen in the first 3 months of the previous three years. While health officials seem to be doing a good job detecting and responding to outbreaks, the rapid increase in the numbers of reported measles cases during the first quarter of 2024 represents a renewed threat to elimination.
Continuing with news from the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger, Ticketmaster faces first in U.S. challenge in California. Musicians fear they could become collateral damage if bill passes. This is written by Andrew Sheeler of the Sacramento Bee, and the dateline is Sacramento, California. A California lawmaker has introduced a bill to take on ticketing giant Ticketmaster, but some recording artists are warning that the bill will empower ticket scalpers instead. If signed by Governor Gavin Newsom, Assembly Bill 2808 by Assemblywoman Buffy Wicks, a Democrat from Oakland, would be the first law of its kind in the nation, the Assemblywoman said at a news conference this week announcing the bill. It is designed to truly transform live event ticketing by increasing competition when tickets go on sale for the first time, the primary point of sale, Wicks said. She pointed out that Ticketmaster controls 80% of primary ticket sales in the U.S., and that since Ticketmaster merged with Live Nation in 2010, ticket prices have risen 140%. The sting of these high prices is made worse by a broken and frustrating system in which folks can wait hours to try to get a ticket, Wicks said. Wicks said her bill would give consumers more choices when it comes to buying tickets. It would do this by requiring ticketing enterprise providers, such as Ticketmaster, to enable participating ticket providers to sell both primary and secondary tickets. It also would prohibit any attempt to limit the transfer or resale of tickets, with a fine of up to $2,500 for each violation. At the end of the day, it's pretty fundamental. It's a basic premise of capitalism. When you have more competition, you have a better product, she said. The bill is supported by the Consumer Federation of California, the California Black Chamber of Commerce, California LULAC, and the National Action Network, as well as musician Jay King. Whether you're an artist, a venue, or a fan, you should have a choice. AB 2808 provides that choice, King said in a statement. The bill, which is set to be heard by the Assembly Arts, Entertainment, Sports, and Tourism Committee later this spring, already has opposition. In response to the bill, Ticketmaster released the following statement. We support reforms to improve ticketing, but AB 2808 will not do that. It will instead undermine the efforts of artists, sports teams, and primary ticketing companies to minimize ticket scalping, forcing artists and venues to hand over their intellectual property and tickets to the secondary sites is a ticket scalper's dream. AB 2808 empowers ticket resellers by blocking any and all price control tools artists can employ, including the use of face value exchanges. A coalition of groups, including the Recording Industry Association of America and SAG-AFTRA, sent a letter of opposition to lawmakers urging a no vote on the bill. AB 2808 was drafted and introduced without any consultation or engagement with artists, venues, or the broader music community. Its primary effect would be to undermine artists' control of ticketing for their shows, drive up prices for their fans by outlawing the most successful consumer affordability tools, and ensure that ticket scalpers, resellers, and illegal bots are able to claim and sell the majority of seats at unchecked, sky-high prices, the letter reads in part. Ron Gubitz, executive director of the Music Artists Coalition, which advocates on behalf of music creators, said AB 2808 will interfere with the relationship between artists and their fans. What this is doing is this is going to take away artists' ability to determine how tickets are sold and resold to fans, he said. He warned that under Wix's legislation, you would have dozens, maybe hundreds of sites selling the same ticket at the same time. Gubitz said that his organization is working to set up a meeting with Wix to discuss how the bill can be recrafted. Next is an article entitled, Instagram Blurs Nudity in Messages to Protect Teens. Social media platform testing new features to fight sexual extortion. It's written by Kelvin Chan of the Associated Press, and the dateline is London. Instagram said it will deploy new tools to protect young people and combat sexual extortion, including a feature that will automatically blur nudity in direct messages. The social media platform said in a blog post Thursday that it's testing out the features as part of its campaign to fight sexual scams and other forms of image abuse, and to make it tougher for criminals to contact teens. Sexual extortion, or sextortion, involves persuading a person to send explicit photos online and then threatening to make the images public unless the victim pays money or engages in sexual favors. Recent high-profile cases include two Nigerian brothers who pleaded guilty to sexually extorting teen boys and young men in Michigan, including one who took his own life, and a Virginia sheriff's deputy who sexually extorted and kidnapped a 15-year-old girl. Instagram and other social media companies face growing criticism for not doing enough to protect young people. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Instagram's owner, Meta Platforms, apologized to the parents of victims of such abuse during a Senate hearing earlier this year. Meta, which is based in Menlo Park, California, also owns Facebook and WhatsApp, but the nudity blur feature won't be added to messages sent on those platforms. Instagram said scammers often use direct messages to ask for intimate images. To counter this, the platform soon will start testing out a nudity protection feature for direct messages that blurs images with nudity and encourages people to think twice before sending nude images. The feature is designed not only to protect people from seeing unwanted nudity in their DMs, but also to protect them from scammers who may send nude images to trick people into sending their own images in return, Instagram said. The feature will be turned on by default globally for teens under the age of 18. Adult users will get a notification encouraging them to activate it. Images with nudity will be blurred with a warning, giving users the option to view it. They'll also get an option to block the sender and report the chat. For people sending direct messages with nudity, they will get a message reminding them to be cautious when sending sensitive photos. They'll also be informed that they can unsend photos if they change their mind, but there's a chance others already may have seen the images. As with many of Meta's tools and policies around child safety, critics see the move as a positive step, but one that does not go far enough. I think the tools announced can protect senders, and that is welcome. But what about recipients, said Arturo Bejar, former engineering director at the social media giant who was known for his expertise in curbing online harassment. He said 1 in 8 teens receives an unwanted advance on Instagram every 7 days, citing internal research he compiled while at Meta that he presented in November, testimony before Congress. What tools do they get? What can they do if they get an unwanted nude? Behar said things won't meaningfully change until there is a way for a teen to say they've received an unwanted advance and there is transparency about it. Here's a couple short articles under the Digest heading. First, Menendez and his wife will face separate trials, Dateline New York. U.S. Senator Bob Menendez and his wife will be tried separately on allegations they participated in a bribery scheme, a federal judge ruled Thursday, after Nadine Menendez's lawyers argued she requires treatment for a serious medical condition. The New Jersey Democrats' trial will remain scheduled for May the 6th in Manhattan federal court, while Nadine Menendez's trial was tentatively pushed back to July the 8th. Her lawyers argued for the move this week, saying she was diagnosed with an unspecified condition and will need surgery in coming weeks. In court Thursday, they said she needs more time to undergo medical tests. A lawyer for the senator urged the judge not to hold up his client's day in court. Prosecutors argued separate trials would result in serious inefficiencies and unfairness that would require dozens of witnesses to be recalled. And fight breaks out after plea in children's killing, Dateline New Orleans. A fight broke out in a New Orleans courtroom Thursday after a man pleaded guilty to murdering his three children in an arson house fire last year. New Orleans news outlets report that a woman related to the children attacked Joseph Washington when he pleaded guilty to first-degree murder. Other relatives joined in the attack before deputies restored order. One arrest was reported. Washington's plea came after prosecutors agreed not to seek the death penalty in the case, meaning Washington will spend the rest of his life in prison. He set fire to his ex-wife's house in October in what Police Chief Ann Kirkpatrick called a horrific act of domestic violence. Police said the fire killed a 3-year-old boy, a 5-year-old girl, and an 8-year-old boy. Police said the children's mother, who was not at home at the time, called 911 saying the children's father planned to burn down the house. Moments later, the fire was reported. Next up is an article entitled Gridshock Film Shows Impact of Human Trafficking. Presentation set for Saturday at Larimar. It's written by Brent Hayworth of the Fort Dodge Messenger. A town hall meeting Saturday will enable people to learn how human trafficking takes away the choices of those who are forced to undertake sex acts for money. Randy Kuhlman, Chief Executive Officer of the Fort Dodge Community Foundation and United Way, said human trafficking is a scourge that negatively impacts people. He wants people to come and learn about the topic, which they may not know a lot about. The majority of criminal activity in human trafficking goes unreported. The victims are trying to extricate themselves from the power imbalance and fear being arrested for prostitution if they contact law enforcement officials. The event, set up by the Safe Communities Coalition, will begin at 10 a.m. in the Larimar Ballroom, 710 First Avenue North. The session will begin with a 50-minute documentary by a native Iowan, then a question-and-answer portion will follow. The documentary, Gridshock, is by Vanessa McNeil, who is a survivor of sexual violence. Kuhlman said Gridshock is a great way to frame the trafficking topic for people. McNeil, on her website, notes that while she's proud of the documentary, it is a difficult topic and can trigger some people as they hear the firsthand details of sex trafficking survivors from Iowa. The question and answer session will be led by Ray Fiedler, coordinator for the State Office to Combat Human Trafficking, and two counselors who work with victims and survivors. Kuhlman said that comes from working with those who have been trafficked. People may erroneously think sex trafficking only takes place in large cities. However, according to the Blue Campaign, a national public awareness campaign devoted to preventing human trafficking, it is a problem everywhere in all 50 states, including rural communities. According to a report by the Iowa Office to Combat Human Trafficking, there were 71 human trafficking tips and leads received by the agency in 2023. Law enforcement authorities report that trafficking victims are often teenage girls and young women. Young men are also victimized by sex traffickers, with LGBTQ people particularly vulnerable. The traffickers often aim for people on the margins of society, since those who are poor, are runaways, or who have mental health or substance abuse issues can be vulnerable to control. A similar event with the documentary in Humboldt County drew 200 people. Festival offers trip around the world is the title of our next article. Anyone stepping into Triton Cafe on Wednesday had the opportunity to experience fun facts and flavors from around the world without leaving the Iowa Central Community College campus during the 35th annual Focus International Festival of Nations. Displays from more than 25 countries were set up around the cafe and conference room for viewing, featuring landmarks, facts, food, and other tidbits of information about each presenter's country of choice. Sophomore Ash Wachholz's country of choice for the day was Poland. She wore a handmade traditional Polish folk dress created by her sister and shared facts about her favorite aspects of the country, from pierogies, a Polish dumpling, to Sirenka, the mermaid of Warsaw. I had the opportunity to spend about a month in Poland while my sister lived there, said Wachholz. The four ribbons on the dress represent the 4 years she spent there. Wachholz said she also loves the legend of the mermaid and how the mythical creature became a symbol of hope and freedom to the country. Iowa Central culinary students had the opportunity to use their skills and prepare samples of soused herring salad representing Germany, tuna ceviche with orange representing Mexico, and veal blanquette with rice representing France. Culinary student Kay Hugback said he and his classmates took inspiration from some of the dishes they have prepared for the weekly International Menu Nights at Willow Ridge. We've had herring and veal on our menus before, so these are smaller versions of that, said Hugeback. It's been a fun to create and taste foods from different countries. Kawan Stone was inspired by a love of anime, which led him to create a poster on Japan and the various forms of the art, as well as Japanese food, language, and culture. I've always been a huge anime fan, he said. I know a lot of students here with the same interest, so I knew they'd appreciate it. I've learned a lot more about the Japanese culture and food, too. Paulina Khan, an international student from Mexico, presented on her home country and had a display of popular Mexican drinks and candies. I wanted to share my home country, said Khan. I like teaching others the culture and who Mexico is as a country. In addition to the posters and presentations, Great Western Dining served an internationally themed lunch for all students, staff, and guests, which featured dishes from Mexico, India, Great Britain, and Kenya. Countries represented at the Focus Festival included Somalia, Mexico, Bahamas, Zimbabwe, Fiji, England, South Africa, Brazil, China, France, Poland, Benin, India, Saudi Arabia, Canada, Argentina, Vietnam, Hungary, Japan, Ivory Coast, Norway, Costa Rica, Colombia, and Uruguay. We're very happy with the turnout today, said Jessica Butterfield Bailey, festival coordinator. It's a great way to celebrate cultures and countries from around the world and especially highlight our international students and their countries and traditions. Now it's time to move on to the sports, and here's what's on TV today. In college baseball, 7 p.m. on BTN, you can see Minnesota at Michigan. 7 p.m. on ESPNU, it's LSU at Tennessee. 7 p.m. on SEC Network, it's Mississippi State at Mississippi. College softball, 5 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, Minnesota at Indiana. SEC Network at 5 p.m., it's Arkansas at South Carolina. 6 p.m. on the ACC Network, it's North Carolina State at Virginia. 6 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Duke at Clemson. 7 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network, Oregon at Arizona. And 9 p.m. on the Pac-12 Network, California at UCLA. In golf, at 2 p.m. on ESPN, you can see the Masters. And then again at 7 p.m. on ESPN, you can see the Masters. Major League Baseball today, 7 p.m. on the MLB Network. It's Texas at Houston. And 10 p.m. on the MLB Network, it's San Diego at the Los Angeles Dodgers. In the NBA, on the NBA TV channel, at 7 p.m., you can see Milwaukee at Oklahoma City. And at 9:30 p.m. on the NBA TV channel, you can see Phoenix at Sacramento. And in the National Hockey League on the NHL Network at 7 p.m., it's Carolina at St. Louis. In local sports, Dodgers fall on the road. Dateline Marshalltown. Fort Dodge boys tennis team dropped an 8-3 decision here Thursday to Marshalltown. Micah Flaherty and Akramjan Abdurakhimov were winners in singles as the two paired up to also claim a doubles victory. Flaherty won 6-1, 6-1, with Abdurakhimov posting a 6-4, 7-6, 7-3 victory. Their doubles score was 6-2, 6-3. The conditions were just brutal, FDSH head coach Scott Messerly said. Micah and AJ did a nice job of adjusting out there. Marshalltown is a very good, experienced team. Next action for Fort Dodge will be Friday when they head to Des Moines Roosevelt. Wildcats run in Adel. Dateline is Adel, Iowa. The Humboldt boys track team took to action at the Adel ADM relays here Thursday night. The Wildcats were third overall behind the host and Ankeny Centennial. Elliot Carlson captured the long jump, with the 4x800 relay also placing first. The quartet of Jackson Dodd, Chase Flaherty, Jackson Flaherty, and Mason Van Pelt set a new meet record in the course. The shuttle hurdle relay of Cohen Matson, Tyler Carlson, Mason Brown, and Keegan Grote placed second. And area teams compete on track. Dateline Forest City. Eagle Grove and Clarion Goldfield Dows were in action here Thursday at the Forest City Boys Relays. The Eagles finished third behind host Indians and Iowa Falls Alden, with the Cowboys placing sixth. Landon Merla won the long jump for Eagle Grove as Josh Miller was second in the high jump. Felix Reyes, sprint medley relay, 4x100 relay, and 4x800 relays all placed third. For Clarion Goldfield Dows, Mason Allen captured the discus. And Dodgers compete at Ankeny. Dateline is Ankeny, Iowa. The Fort Dodge Middle School track team was in action here Thursday. Luke Beckley had three top four individual finishes to lead the Dodgers, placing second in the 100, third in the 200, and fourth in the 400. The Fort Dodge distance medley relay of Brooklyn Nelson, Charlotte DeYoung, Zoe Balm, and Paisley Mundy placed second overall. Avery Bryhue was third in the 800, with the boys' distance medley relay of Amari McCaleb, Joshua Townsend, Eli Pritchard, and Brian also taking third. Addison Freeth was fourth in the 100 hurdles. Mundy finished fourth in the 800, and Brody Mail was fourth in the shot put. Fort Dodge's shuttle hurdle relay of Cale Adams, Des Behrens, Reggie Peterson, and Pritchard placed fourth, as did both 4x800 relays. The boys' quartet was Joseph Peterson, Brian Miles, Summers, and Brexton Holmes, with Balm, Atlea Gupfert, Linny Pratt, and Mundy running the girls' relay. Charlotte Bresser in the 400, McCaleb in the high jump, and Nelson in the high jump were each fifth. Now we come to an article about the Iowa women's basketball team entitled Thanks for the Memories. Clark's number retired as fans celebrate Hawkeyes. It's written by John Bonenkamp. Dateline is Iowa City. Caitlin Clark got a final chance to say goodbye to Iowa fans on Wednesday, and of course there was a big crowd waiting. Clark, who became major college basketball's all-time leading scorer this season on the way to being the consensus National Player of the Year, was honored along with her teammates in a celebration at Iowa's home arena, commemorating the Hawkeyes' second consecutive national runner-up finish in the NCAA tournament. "I would say you've all inspired me as much as I inspired you," Clark said to the approximately 8,000 fans at Iowa's Carver Hawkeye Arena. "And you allowed me to live out my dream every single day, and for that I'm very thankful. It's been very special, and this place will always be home to me." Clark, expected to be the number one overall pick by the Indiana Fever on Monday's WNBA draft, finished her career with 3,951 points and 1,144 assists, an All-American in every season, in a career that started playing in front of sparse crowds during her freshman year when attendance was limited because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Clark received a standing ovation when Iowa Athletics Director Beth Goetz announced that Clark's jersey number 22 will be retired, the third number to be retired in program history. "I think they like you," Goetz said to Clark after the announcement. "It's super incredible, something I'm very thankful for," Clark said. "There's been a lot of good 22s who have come before me and played for this program, whether it was Kathleen Doyle or Sam Logic. That number holds a lot of weight, far beyond me. I'm really grateful, and it will be a special day when it happens." Iowa coach Lisa Bluter called the Hawkeyes' back-to-back runs to the national championship game special. "This year's was also special because nobody thought we could do it," she said. "Nobody thought we could repeat what we did last year, except these women up here." The attendance for the event wasn't surprising given the Hawkeyes' ability to draw crowds this season. The Hawkeyes sold out every home game, drawing 238,620 fans during the regular season, and that total doesn't include the 55,646 fans who showed up for the crossover at Kinnick outdoor exhibition game in October at Iowa's Kinnick Stadium that set the women's basketball single-game attendance record. Iowa also sold out its two NCAA tournament games at home. The weekend attendance of 28,764 was the most of any first weekend site in the women's tournament. "Please come back next year," Lisa Bluter said. "Please fill Carver Hawkeye Arena next year." Fans were lined up outside of the arena more than 2 hours before the event started, racing to find seats when the doors opened. Angie Lay of Atlantic, Iowa, brought her 10-year-old daughter Lana, who was celebrating her birthday, to the event. The Lays had been to one game this season, attending Iowa's NCAA tournament opener against Holy Cross. But when Angie saw this event was going to be held on her daughter's birthday, they decided to make the 3-hour drive to come back one more time. "We were going to drop everything to make sure she could be here," Lay said, as her daughter held up a sign with her birthday wish list asking for a chance to meet Clark or at least get an autograph or a photo. "All of this is amazing." Clark circled the arena floor to sign autographs after the event, as she has after games throughout her career. She spoke during the event how she and her two brothers idolized athletes growing up. "I wanted to be like them," she said. "Those were the people who allowed me to dream and to be in moments like this." Lay knew what the Hawkeyes' recent success meant to her daughter, whose sign also said about Clark, "I want to be just like you." "It's a dream come true, and it's made her dream bigger," Lay said. O.J. Simpson passes away at the age of 76. It's written by Rob Modhai. Long before the Bronco chase gripped a national television audience and the trial of the century captivated this country, O.J. Simpson was making his mark on the football field. Simpson passed away on Thursday at the age of 76 after a battle with cancer. The Juice was the best running back of his era during an 11-year NFL career, mostly played with the Buffalo Bills. He won a national championship and a Heisman Trophy in college and set records in the NFL. But Simpson's accomplishments on the field were overshadowed and his image was forever ruined by charges that he killed his former wife and her male friend in 1994. Though he was acquitted of murder, Simpson was later found liable for the deaths in a separate civil case. Simpson's tarnished legacy resulted in a muted reaction to news of his death Thursday. He wasn't acknowledged publicly by the NFL, the Bills, or the San Francisco 49ers, where he played his final two seasons. Pro Football Hall of Fame issued a statement attributed to its president, Jan Porter, that said O.J. Simpson was the first player to reach a rushing mark many thought could not be attained in a 14-game season when he topped 2,000 yards. His on-field contributions will be preserved in the Hall's archives in Canton, Ohio. Simpson's name remains on the Bills' Wall of Fame, which rings the inside of Highmark Stadium, known as Rich Stadium during his playing days. That could change in a few years when the Bills move into a new stadium set to open across the street in 2026. Fans previously petitioned the team to remove Simpson's name from the wall. Otherwise, there are very few reminders of Simpson's playing time in Buffalo. No statues. Many of his teammates and friends have moved away or died. He and I had a bumpy start, and then we had a great relationship throughout, former Bills defensive back Booker Edgerson told the AP, because he was a celebrity, and in his ways, he just didn't understand. He was a young guy. He didn't understand the game of professional football and what all the guys went through. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.